Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 528, interview with Daniel Hopsicker about the Gus Boulos murder. This has been recorded on October 2nd of the year 2005. Once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to be joined by the heroic Daniel Hopsicker, who has been on the ground in Florida looking into a number of aspects of some of the 911 hijackers affairs in South Florida, something a lot of not too many people have been doing. Daniel, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Hey, Dave, good to be with you.
So, how's the view from the bridge down there in South Florida these days?
Well, things are popping, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
It looks as if this Jack Abramoff, Tom DeLay, Gus Boulos murder thing could become the big, at least to me, it looks as if it could be the biggest scandal since Watergate, and it could even be bigger because there's already murders involved. As I reported 3 months ago, it's a clear melding of the financial end of the Republican Party and the mob, and resulted in murder. It's going to be interesting to see where it goes, because it can't go anywhere except one place, which is fascinating. I mean, Jack Abramoff, the chief Republican lobbyist, the guy that raised the money that made George Bush president in 2000 and 2004, put his own man in at Sun Cruise Casinos, which are a dozen unregulated gambling boats that they took over 4 years ago, named Adam Kidden. Adam Kidden was there for no other reason than his ability to keep his mouth shut, but obviously not because he's a rocket scientist, because he wrote checks totaling $250,000 to a Gambino Goomba who has just been charged with the murder of the man that owned the gambling boats.
Yeah, what I'd like to do, Daniel, I'd like to sort of ease into the subject of the Sun Cruise ships and Abramoff and the murders. One of the things that you've been doing down there is researching what I call evidentiary tributaries, running backward in time and also connecting a number of different kinds of operations and also some different historical episodes, which to most people at least are separate, if not altogether mysterious. One of the things that you've uncovered down there is the fact that Mohammed Atta and some of the other 911 hijackers were in fact involved with an international criminal milieu that was involved with, among other things, heroin smuggling. And recently, some disclosures slash allegations by Kurt Weldon, a Republican senator, have once again focused attention on what Mohammed Atta was doing in the United States in the run-up to September 11th. Now, we've spoken about some of the allegations of surveillance of Mohammed Atta before. You have just recently published a piece that shows that a fellow named Joe Gazelle was hired by a cab company in Venice, and this adds some more depth to the whole Able Danger question. I wonder if you tell us, first of all, Daniel, what was the Able Danger program? Tell us about the heroin smuggling in Hamburg that they were looking into, and then who is Joe Gazelle, and why was he driving a cab in Venice, and when did he come, when did he go?
Well, Able Danger, as probably all of your readers know, was a secret military intelligence unit run out of Tampa, Florida, that had identified Mohammed Atta in 1999 as a potential terrorist. And in the middle of 2000, they attempted to pass that information, according to Republican Congressman Kurt Weldon, on to the FBI for action, and they were prevented somehow from doing that. And of course, it is Weldon's contention and his interest, I believe, in the case to pin that on Clinton administration officials as being soft on terrorism. Be that as it may, the most interesting part of what's come out so far about this unit is that they had identified Mohammed Atta in 1999, which nobody has noticed except me, because I've been reporting that the FBI has been lying about when Mohammed Atta first arrived in this country. If they had identified him in 1999, he was obviously here a year earlier than the FBI says he was. Now, the FBI's story of Mohammed Atta's chronology, which is the basic investigative tool, has been shown to be a lie, even by government people themselves. The Department of Agriculture official who received a small business loan request from Atta in April of 2000 to buy a crop duster. I mean, she had, I mean, when you submit a loan application, you put the date on it, and she has all that, and they shut her up. So he, you know, so that was my interest in it initially. But then it reminded me of something. We had interviewed the day driver for Venice Yellow Cab, there's only one, who had ferried Atta around quite a bit during the last month before the attack, when he was in Venice almost completely that entire month. And that was interesting. He had a lot to say. He picked up Mohammed Atta and Rudy Dekkers, for example, and took them partying at the Gator Club up in Sarasota, which is enough probably to put Rudy Dekkers in prison for the rest of his life. Now, this cab driver is an eminently credible witness. He's a Navy veteran. His testimony was used by the FBI to deport three Saudis who had just arrived in this country that he knew had been picked up and rode around with Atta. So he's eminently credible witness, and he had knew Rudy Dekkers well because he had picked up all of Dekkers' flight students when they came in and took them to their Dekkers-funded pads. Now, one of the things he said was, because the FBI got in touch with him immediately, like 2 days afterwards, they had pictures of him at Orlando Airport, and he told us all about it, and then he said, you know, the FBI was even more interested in talking to the night driver.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, the day driver was named Simpson, was he not?
Yeah, right. He mm-hmm. said, you know, I mean, I drove him around, but the night driver had him a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, so now I'm remembering what he had told us about the night driver. The night driver was a guy named Joe Jessel, who showed up on August 6th and said he was in town for a month and could he get a job. And he left. That was the day Otto arrived back from dropping off Siad al-Jarrah in Miami for his last trip. And then the day driver, Simpson said this guy left 1 month later on September 8th, which is the day after Otto left town for the last time. So, and he had told us that this guy had identified himself as a former U.S. Navy SEAL, and he was extremely buff, had a short haircut, made Simpson think maybe he could perhaps even still be a Navy SEAL. So, you know, none of that really had come to mind until this Able Danger stuff came out, and I thought, well, who was this guy, Joe Jessel? So I began to look into him, and what I've discovered so far just leads to more questions. He had identified himself as a Navy SEAL. I contacted the Navy SEAL Association, and they don't have anybody by that name listed, which isn't definitive because if he was a current Navy SEAL, they perhaps would not release that information. But then I went to ran a background search on the guy and got the address that he had lived at in Venice while he was here. Went to the address and met an elderly couple that's rented the small two-bedroom house for 4 years, and they didn't know any Joe Jessel, but she said, and she was a little upset, she said, well, I get dunning letters from him for him every once in a while. You know, he still gets mail here, you know. So, you know, she was like mildly upset with that. So I knew the guy had lived there. She said you could find out more about him by going to the condo rental place in Venice that rented the house. So I went to the condo rental place last week to seek more information about him, and they looked it up, and they were kind enough to look it up in their files for me, and that house, as far as they knew, had been vacant for an entire year, that entire year, while it was being remodeled. So the guy was indubitably there because they still receive mail for him, and yet the condo rental place says that the house wasn't rented at all in 2001. And I said, well, could the owner have rented it without your knowledge? Well, the owner is an absentee owner, doesn't even live here, and they had complete control of it. So, you know, we've got a mystery there. So then I tried to get in touch with Bob Simpson. I went back to the headquarters of Venice Yellow Cab, and see, they had given us Gessel's work history when we visited him 2.5 years ago. So we knew he had worked there for this 1 month. Well, I went back there a week and a half ago, and they've got no record of him now.
So something has changed. They had a work history, and now they don't have a work history.
Correct.
Were you able to find out why? And it was like, well, what happened to the disappearing work history?
Yeah, correct. So I dug out. I had done a video interview with Bob Simpson, you know, 2.5 years ago, and I had never used the video interview. I was planning on maybe using it in a future show. So I dug out the video interview, and sure enough, he'd said what I'd quoted him as saying, and I was going to put it up on my website. Indeed, it is up on my website now. And as I prepared to do that, I realized I would need some B-roll footage, which is of Venice Yellow Cab riding around town. so we wouldn't have to look at this guy's face for 8 minutes. So I placed a call to Venice Yellow Cab and ordered a cab, and someone came out and picked me up, and, you know, he said, ride me out to Huffman, and told him why I was doing it, and the guy remembered. He knew Bob Simpson, and I told him about the strange disappearing work history of this guy, Joe Gessel, who he did not remember because he had not been working there at the time. The cab driver hadn't. And he said, well, maybe the FBI told him not to say anything. And I said, well, why would you say that? And he said, well, I don't know why I'd say that. but there it was. So now I'm looking for Bob Simpson. And the cab driver, you know, I said, do you know where, how I can get in touch with Bob Simpson? Because I know he doesn't live in town anymore. And the cab driver says, well, we heard he died. We heard he had been killed tragically in a house fire.
Bob Simpson?
Yeah, the cab driver.
Yeah, but not Joe Gessel.
Yeah, right. No, not Joe Gessel. Bob Simpson, the cab driver we'd interviewed, the day cab driver. And I was upset because he was a nice guy. I was upset enough about that to want to pursue it to a conclusion. So I looked up in our notes, and sure enough, we had extensive notes in which he identified his father was a assistant chief of police in the Pleasant Hill, California police force. And his mother, who he was proud of, had started her own company, a small little computer consulting firm, and she gave the name of the company. So we had written it down in the notes. Never, you know, of course, wasn't of interest to anyone really at that point. But I was able to track back. I called Vena Pleasant Hill Police, and his dad was down in New Orleans helping with relief, and so they couldn't get in touch with him. Then I called his mother, and his mother was in Greece on vacation. But she called me back the next week, and she said, "Oh no, Bob's not dead. He's living in Oregon now." And I said, well, would you ask him to call me? I'm happy that he's alive, and tell him I have a couple questions for him, and ask him to call me. So he called me the next day, and he gave me more information on Joe Gessel. I mean, I said, rack your brains here with me. Here's what I remember you telling me. You know, this guy identified himself as a Navy SEAL. He was young and extremely good shape and had a short haircut. He said, so he remembered a couple of things he hadn't told me before, because they hadn't seemed important at the time. First of all, the guy had not been hired through normal channels. He had, walked into the office and asked for him, and then, gone to see Bob Simpson at home. You know, so applying for a job as a cab driver is kind of like getting a job as a waiter or a busboy. You know, I mean, it's not the kind of thing you're going to track down your employer and knock on his door. But the guy had, and he had knocked on Bob Simpson's door to get himself a job. And Simpson also recalled that the guy, while he did work for the month, had not been very interested in making money. They would call him, the dispatcher would call him with calls, and he would oftentimes not reply. So, I mean, you know, which is not something a cab driver does, because cab drivers are hustling, you know, they don't get paid if they're not ferrying someone around. And so they all found that kind of curious. And the last thing he told me about this guy, Joe Gessel, was that he had a dark Mediterranean appearance, and he seemed to remember that he had a slight accent. So I'm wondering now, and I'm just speculating because I'm, you know, now I've just told you, you know, the new information I have about this guy, which makes me wonder if he wasn't Israeli.
Or because some other nationality. Gessel, I think, is a German extraction last name.
Gessel. It's G-E-S-S-E-L-L.
Oh, it's two S's? That's a German name. But
well,
a German extraction.
Wasn't there a famous actor named Georgie Gessel?
Yeah, that was spelled a little different, I think. But, you know, the point is that this guy was apparently a native of some other country.
I think that is correct.
And apparently that you're saying that the guy was really buff, so he appears to have been involved, quite possibly anyway, with some sort of military service.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt about that, and I think there's no doubt at this point that his appearance and disappearance coinciding with Ada's last month in Venice is suspicious.
Any chance that the name may be phony, that this may have been an alias?
Hey, every chance of that.
Mm-hmm.
Every chance of that. You know, how you know, of course there is. There is every chance of that. I'm unaware of how to you know, I've kind of told you what I know now.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I found out that in addition to his suspicious appearance and disappearance, that his behavior while he was here was suspicious because he often did not respond to calls.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got someone, you know, 11 o'clock at night, we got someone for you to pick up here, and he didn't respond. So, you know, his chief interest was not in making money. Now I hear that he had a Mediterranean appearance and here, as you remember, a slight accent. So we don't even know if he was American. And so I am speculating here. The Israelis supposedly had the hijackers under surveillance. I'm speculating. I'm wondering if he could have been Israeli.
It's a possibility, certainly. It's interesting to contemplate. What I'm wondering, too, is was he actually surveilling Atta, or was he somehow working with him? Was he actually a part of the team?
I would have no way of knowing that for sure, but let's speculate here a minute. Getting a job as a cab driver to keep track of someone that you know is taking a lot of cabs, which Otto was known to do,
mm-hmm.
Would be a good way of keeping track of him.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, the activities that I've just described are enough, so I believe we can conclude that whoever this guy was, he was keeping track of Otta.
Mm-hmm.
Given that he arrived when Otta got back and left the day after Otta left. Now, you know, beyond that, I don't think we can say much.
One of the things that's striking, Daniel, in your book, Welcome to Terrorland, and also vis-a-vis a lot of the articles that you published, both before, during, and after the publication of the book, is that the professional histories of virtually all of the people involved with Atta and company down in Florida are extraordinary, and this is yet another person whose work history and professional behavior is atypical with a capital A.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So,
we're looking at spook stuff here.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We are looking at the clandestine world. If there is one thing the government has been exceptionally eager to tell us, it's that 19 hijackers moved through Europe and America unnoticed when nothing could be further from the truth. Atta originally, his reason to go for going to Hamburg was because he was recruited by a German couple, and for the 7 years he was in Hamburg, he was being paid by a joint U.S.-German program called the Congress Bundestag Program. So U.S. PAC taxpayers, the U.S. government knew about Otto while he was in Hamburg because American money went to support him. That's been established. You know, so, and now we have this military intelligence unit saying they had tabs on him. The number of foreign intelligence services supposedly watching him while he was in Hamburg is extensive. So the one thing we can be sure of is that he did not escape notice.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned a couple things, Daniel. You mentioned in a previous article about the Able Danger Unit that they had been tracking Al-Qaeda-related heroin smuggling coming through Hamburg as early as 1991.
Right. Well, you want to hear that story? This is an interesting story. I don't think I've told the whole story to anybody. Tell me. I mean, stop me.
No. It's interesting. I do want to do. There are a couple of more things vis-a-vis the cab traveling of Mohammed Atta I wanted to review because we do want to get to the discussion of Abramoff and these Gambino-related figures who've been indicted for the murder of Gus Bulis, whose operations were taken over by Jack Abramoff, the largest GOP operative. Anyways, but no, go ahead. Tell us about the Hamburg-related smuggling.
This story kind of tells you put you into the picture, I think, okay? I had been down here for just about a year. It was like late 2002, and published a number of stories when I became aware that there was a two- or three-man team from somewhere going around and interviewing every witness I had named in any of my stories, because I started getting calls from them. This guy came to see me today, wanted to know if I had told you what I told you, okay? So eventually I got a call from the guy who said he was responsible for re-interviewing all of these witnesses, and he said, I'd like to buy you dinner. And I said, well, hey, sure, I'd be happy to. I wondered who he was. So I met the guy, here was his cover story, and it was an excellent cover story. He told me that he had been engaged by a famous American writer to come down and see if I was talking through my hat, if the witnesses that I had quoted saying the startling things they said, whether I was making it up. And the reason for this, he told me, was because if indeed my reporting was accurate, this famous American writer wanted to do a book with me. Well, you can imagine how that made me feel. I'm going, oh, great, cool. Someone's noticed.
Mm-hmm.
So he would not tell me who the famous American writer was, okay? But he left enough clues. So, I mean, it was easy to figure out that the individual he was referring to was Tom Clancy, who's written, you know, who's got, like, extensive intelligence sources and written a whole bunch of books about American clandestine services. Well, this would have certainly, you know, gotten what I've discovered down here far more attention than I've been able to bring it. So the next thing he said to me was, tell me a few things that I can take back to him that will make up his mind to like do a book with you. So of course they did. I mean, I can be lied to successfully. I mean, there's no doubt we all can. Okay. So in hindsight, you know, that's kind of funny because he wasn't indeed working for Tom Clancy. I eventually discovered and it was kind of interesting the way I discovered it, and it's longer than you want to hear now, but I eventually discovered that he had an office in a high-rise on the Orlando International Airport that was controlled by clandestine services. There were a dozen companies listed at this same dummy mail drop, all of which looked to be CIA fronts or intelligence fronts of some sort, and his name was listed there. So when he told me he had retired from the military, that probably was not true. He was still actively engaged working for someone. But he was not, so everything he told me could have been a lie, but I don't believe it was. He told me that he had been a military CID, because they don't lie to you completely. They just mix truth and lies in a way that you're never totally, you know, able to, like, you know, figure out what's what. But he told me he had been in the military, and he certainly had a military bearing, and that he had been in military CID, which is internal security in the military. You know, it's their investigative arm of the military, and that he had been detailed to Hamburg back in 1991 by the military to track the flow of heroin coming out of Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew, from you know, and I believe that he was telling me the truth when he said that, you know, and it became, you know, I mean, the U.S. military was interested in Al-Qaeda's heroin flows and, you know, or heroin flowing out of Afghanistan as early as the year, you know, way back in 1991.
Mm-hmm.
So none of this could have been a surprise. I mean, it certainly makes sense, along with everything else we're learning, that Otto was not an unknown quantity.
And one of the things I want to point out, Daniel, we're almost out of time on this side, is that drug smuggling in general and heroin smuggling in particular is something that crops up throughout the investigative field, not only of Mohammed Atta's activities in Florida, but also of a number of other elements whose activities at one point or another overlap or cross with the path of Mohammed Atta. Real quick, the Venice cab. Bob Simpson, you mentioned him before, and he described some cab-related travel between Mohammed Atta a man who appeared to be Zaharias Moussaoui, a Saudi prince, and a very, very interesting and well-connected convenience store owner. I wonder, in our last couple of minutes, if you could encapsulate that for us.
Yeah, well, that tells us a ton of stuff that we never knew, which has since been confirmed, actually. He took a number of trips to Orlando Airport to pick up Saudi dignitaries. In fact, that's how the FBI got in touch with them. They had pictures of him at Orlando International Airport waiting for luggage to come out of this rich Saudi prince that flew in and came back to Venice. And when this rich Saudi prince left 6 weeks later, spent 6 weeks in Venice, when he left 6 weeks later, Simpson was asked to take him back to the airport. And when he got to the apartment building to pick him up, he was asked to come upstairs because they had a chest to take down to the cab. And it looked like a woman's hope chest, you know, kind of that you see at the bottom of a bed, he told me. And he could not believe how heavy it was. It took two people to pick it up, him and a bald guy that he identified as Zaharias Moussaoui. And Zaharias Moussaoui has since been confirmed by none other than Rudy Deckers as having been in Venice, but you've never heard that anywhere else. But the interesting thing was he could not stop talking about how heavy this chest was, and he couldn't, I mean, never picked up anything that small that was that heavy, had, you know, what the heck could have been in there? So I called this guy that I knew to have been in American intelligence for 35 years, and I described what he had just told me and asked him what he was, and he didn't pause. He knew exactly what it was. He said it was gold. And I guess the point of this little story is that gold and heroin are fungible elements used by spooks worldwide. These are the currencies of their trade. The other interesting thing about it is the apartment from which this rich Saudi came to the U.S. and left from the U.S. was rented by a man by the name of Makram Chams, a Lebanese man who owned a convenience store right across the street where the terrorists hung out as well.
Let's come back, Daniel.
Let me just get this out. Right. That convenience store is where Marwan al-Shehhi got the money, their money order from the UAE. The biggest lump sum they got was $70,000, and it was the address to which that came was Makram Chams' convenience store. And Makram Chams disappeared immediately after September 11th and has not been seen in town since. And his store has sat abandoned to this day. Sits abandoned at the convenience store. Sits abandoned.
Well, isn't that convenient? Daniel, real quick, you have a number of things for sale without giving prices. Tell people where they can view the wares, so to speak.
Yes, please help us out because we need it at madcowprod.com. We've got five documentaries and two books, and I need support to keep going. This has been a tough month for everybody with the hurricanes. And you know, but we don't have the government sponsored kind of thing going on, and it's always a month by month thing. So if anybody can help, please do.
If somebody's got a footlocker full of gold they can bring Daniel, please run it on down to Venice, California. We have been speaking with Daniel Hopsicker, the author of, among other titles, Welcome to Tehran, Mohammed Atta and the 9/11 Cover-Up in Florida, and Barry and the Boys about Barry Seal, about whom we'll say more in the second side. We will be returning to our visit with Daniel Hopsicker in Side 2. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 528, interview with Daniel Hopsicker about the Gus Bulis murder. This is being recorded on October 2nd of 2005. For Daniel Hopsicker, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.